States against San Marino. Mr. Stevenson.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Adam Stevenson. I represent the appellant, Mr. Brian Anarino. Among several, this case raises two concerns, both involving Mr. Anarino's significantly diminished capacity. First, the District Court improperly increased Mr. Anarino's sentence because of his diminished capacity. This Court rejects and prohibits such aggravation.
Though the government does Garthus prohibit that? I thought we indicated that, in essence, if the defendant is incapable, if there's evidence that the defendant is incapable of controlling his behavior, for example, here we've got the continued efforts to get access to child pornography after he's in custody on these charges, protection of the public is a legitimate concern.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that slightly. Garthus did state that psychological limitations, mental limitations, can be used as aggravating factors, mitigating factors, or ignored entirely. Mm-hmm. However, a prior case, Durham, noted, and I'm quoting, "a finding of diminished capacity should never be used as an aggravating factor for sentencing purposes." Garthus, while decided after Durham, said nothing of overruling that statement, overruling that finding.
Well, it was dicta in Durham, wasn't it?
I would disagree in that the way to reconcile the cases is that when it is just the mental limitation or the psychological disorder on its own with no connection to the offense, therefore no direct culpability aspect to it, then it is a different situation. That is the situation present in Garthus and Durham. However, diminished capacity, its direct connection to the offense, and it being a partial impetus for the offense, is a different matter. And that was the discussion in Durham, was that there's a fine line between those two points.
Well, that seems to see. Well, go ahead.
What in the record indicates that the diminished capacity was the impetus to the offense? Did an expert testify to that, or did the judge find it?
Yes, Your Honor. An expert did testify as to Mr. Anarino's several mental disabilities, of which included very low IQ, ADD, ADHD, and others. Most importantly, however, there was a scientific testing done to demonstrate that he is highly susceptible to suggestion. And there was also testimony on the part of the Canadian inmate, the impetus for this case, as well as others, that Mr. Anarino...
I understand all that, but he has a diminished capacity. But if that is authority rather than dictum, the diminished capacity has to have been the impetus for the offense. I don't think Judge Zagel made that finding. Is there something in the record that indicates, or any opinion that says that, or is it just an inference that the defense believes to be true?
There were several items where it was demonstrated that Mr. Anarino's transmission of these items, as well as other actions involved in the case, were brought about by the Canadian inmate, by David Holst, right, whom he cooperated with the government to uncover, and others. Actions were always brought about at the behest of other individuals. There was not an explicit finding made. However, Judge Zagel at sentencing did note Mr. Anarino had very limited mental functioning, as well as the other items testified to by the expert. And it is that connection to the offense, in addition to the actual diminished capacity, that brings it out of that situation in Garthus, where it can be used as an aggravating factor, a mitigating factor, ignored entirely, and more as indicated in Durham, where when it has a direct causal role to the offense itself, it should not be used as an aggravating factor.
Why not? I understand the point in terms of just desserts and. But a district judge is also entitled to take into account protection of the public from further crimes by this defendant. Why isn't that relevant?
In large part because, as opposed to an individual who acts repeatedly because of some other condition, the defendant does not have internal control over this condition absent treatment. And therefore, it's not because of what the defendant does, it is because of who the defendant is. And therefore, treatment as opposed to incapacitation should be the focus of that particular aspect of the sentence.
Well, that sounds like a good argument to make to a sentencing judge, but a sentencing judge is also entitled, isn't he or she, to say, look, I don't have any confidence this treatment might be successful. I want to make sure this guy doesn't do to other children what he's already done. And if this is beyond his control, I want to give him the maximum sentence I can. Now, Judge Zagel did not give the maximum sentence he could. He actually gave a below-guideline sentence. But but in theory, what's wrong with that?
Well, as to the point with regard to the placement of the sentence relative to the guideline range, as we discussed in our briefs, the guideline range is an unclear matter in this.
No, it's not.
The guideline range is perfectly clear. It's 50 years. If there had been a higher statutory maximum, the guideline range would have been life. And your client got 10 years less than the 50-year guideline range, which makes it very hard to see how you can say, well, the judge was holding this against him. Your client got a discount, just not as big a discount as your client wished to get.
I agree. However, there is, with regard to where the sentencing judge started in the sentence in the sentencing procedure, it is unclear. As the judgment notes, in the blank for the guideline range, it actually indicates 240 months is the guideline range.
So where is
this? What? It's in the judgment statement of reasons.
The statement of reasons says 43 and 1.
Right? Correct, Your Honor. However,
which puts us in life.
I would agree that that would be
the PSR
finding,
said. And the PSR was what the district judge said he found, right?
The judge said that it would be a guideline range getting close to life, a very high guideline range, and in addition, there was that notation of 240 months. What counsel simply asked for is a matter of clarity, a specific finding, one that is consistent so that the starting point of the sentence is clear, such that the remaining journey at sentencing can be evaluated under that light. That actually brings me well to my second point with regard to the district court judge's speculation at sentencing that further influenced the sentence and goes to the reasonability of the sentence. Similar to Bradley and Miller, the district court here speculated with regard to Mr. Anarino's reoffense risk without specific citation. The district court here noted that the court wanted Mr. Anarino incapacitated for a sufficiently long period of time until he reaches an age where it would be difficult for him to participate in child exploitation issues. But there is no direct citation as to when that age would occur, why that
presumably after 40 years, less 15%.
That would appear to be the judge's indication. However, there's no citation in terms of how that change would come about, why that change would come about. In addition, facts actually in the record.
Well, do you have any data about the rate of sexual exploitation of children by age? That is, most crimes decline as age increases. And I assume that's true of sexual exploitation of children. There must be data about that. Have you looked to see whether there are data about that?
I have not included any in my brief. However, it is also my understanding that as age increases, specifically as an individual achieves an age of 60 or more, there is a significant decline in these types of offenses. And it is that in part with that, Mr. Anarino's...
Was the district judge presented with any of these data in an effort to educate him about how long somebody should be held for the purpose of incapacitation?
He was not, Your Honor. However, I will note that in Miller... This court did note that the district court's comments were actually contrary to studies on sex offender recidivism rates, though those facts were also not presented to the district court. With that, if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my time for a moment.
Mr. Turr.
May it please the Court, Paul Zurr for the United States. The district court didn't commit any procedural or substantive error when it imposed a 40-year sentence below the guideline range on the defendant. Now, procedurally, the district court said enough on the record.
There are a lot of these sexual abuse of minors cases, so you'd think it would be in the government's interest, at least, to have a ready-to-hand set of the social science data so you could answer a district judge's questions about how long does somebody need to be held to materially reduce the risk of recidivism. I gather nothing was presented here. I'm surprised that nothing was in your brief.
Your Honor, nothing was in our brief because nothing was presented to the district court from either side about
social science evidence. Evidence is something that judges can consult whether or not it's presented to the district court. Mr. Stevenson mentioned a case in which we reversed the district judge who had mistaken ideas about recidivism and sex offenses, and that's because the appellate lawyers did indeed marshal that evidence and present it to the Court of Appeals. But here, everybody seems to be talking off the top of his head. And you know, we keep emphasizing that it's very good to have evidence-based law, just like we have evidence-based medicine. This sentence is heavily influenced by beliefs about future risks of recidivism. Now, it's hard to fault the district court, since the parties have been absolutely silent. But wouldn't it be better if we made these decisions on the basis of evidence rather than on the basis of intuition?
I suppose it would be better, Your Honor, of course. To have the statistics in front of us, of course. But statistics are statistics, and I'm an engineer background, so I understand the shortcomings in statistics.
Yeah, don't build bridges on the basis of intuition. I don't see why we should send people to 40 years in prison on the basis of intuition.
It's more than
intuition.
It's
very hard to fault the district court when intuition was all either side offered.
It was certainly more than intuition, Your Honor. A defendant put forward his expert, Dr. Frumpkin. The government put forward evidence about the defendant's conduct prior to being pulled into custody and then his conduct in seeking additional child pornography once he was in custody, evidence that the district court credited, evidence that the district court considered. So the district court wasn't working off of a blank slate, Your Honor. It wasn't working entirely off of intuition. It was working off of conduct that and evidence that was presented in front of him about conduct that the defendant had engaged in.
I've been trying to figure out some of what was in front of the sentencing judge. Were there any written objections to the pre-sentence report put before the judge or any sentencing memoranda to find out what was argued to him and what objections were made?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. There was a government's version of offense presented and provided to the probation office prior to the PSR being generated. The government prepared a government sentencing memorandum, a position paper, and defendant also prepared his own defenses, submission defenses position paper. The defendant he presented the position paper, it got file stamped. He didn't put it onto the electronic docket out of concerns of introducing into the public docket minor A's identity. But he did present that position paper to the district court. District court referenced in the record that he had read and understood the defendant's position
and this objections. Didn't get into the record even under seal?
It's part of the record. It was one of the documents that the judge considered. It was file stamped. It just wasn't put onto the electronic CMECF record.
But we should have it in sealed records.
It should be part of the district court record. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Let me just add. Have you seen that paper?
I have, Your Honor.
Okay. The defense talks about a 240-month, a guideline range around 240 months. How was that to be calculated as opposed to what the pre-sentence report calculated?
I think it's worthwhile to take a quick moment and step back toward the plea agreement. In the plea agreement, the parties referenced four different possible guideline ranges. The plea agreement also references that those guideline ranges do not take into account a possible cross-reference under the guideline, the child sex offense guidelines, in the event that the government proves at sentencing that the defendant did, in fact, molest minor A. And it's that molestation that ended up driving the guideline in this case. So the 240-month number that the defendant references, I believe that number comes in at the plea agreement. It's in the plea agreement. That reference is to a guideline not including the cross-reference for molestation. And, again, the plea agreement expressly stated that this cross-reference could apply in the event that the government met its burden at sentencing. Government spent the better part of 2 days meeting that burden. And at the time of argument at sentencing, it was pretty much understood. It seemed pretty obvious to everybody at the time that the government had met its burden of proving that defendant had in fact molested minor A. In fact, the defendant in his arguments made the point of saying that the government put in so much evidence about that molestation that it's evidence that the government would have introduced at a trial to prove that fact beyond a reasonable doubt.
So what, was there ever a defense objection to the cross-reference for the judge to rule on?
There was a written objection, and I'll direct you to, I believe it's page 1. It's in one of the pages to the defendant's written objection, where all he argues about the cross-reference is that it is a fact, the molestation of minor A is a fact that ought to have been proven or ought need be proved to a jury, not or a fact finder, not just the probation officer, beyond a reasonable doubt. That was the extent of his argument about the cross-reference. And then we got to sentencing, and at the sentencing hearing, he made no additional argument about the cross-reference. And the defendant had plenty of opportunities to argue that the cross-reference shouldn't have been applied and that some guideline number, some total offense level below 43 was applicable. I'd like to touch briefly on defendant's argument that on diminished capacity. Defendant didn't argue at sentencing. Certainly not a 5K2.13 argument for diminished mental capacity. And that's what Durham is talking about. Durham talks about the guideline provision. And there's probably a reason why the defendant didn't raise 5K2.13 at sentencing. That provision of the guideline actually expressly prohibits district courts from reducing sentences under for diminished mental capacity when the defendant has been convicted of a crime under Chapter 110, among others. Title 18 United States Code 2252 Big A, possession, trafficking, distribution of child pornography, is a statute that falls under Chapter 110 of Title 18. So in other words, the policy statement under 5K2.13 that diminished mental capacity ought be given a mitigating consideration is expressly barred by that guideline provision. So at the very least, when you get to the only thing that the defendant could have been arguing at sentencing for diminished mental capacity is that it was a mitigating factor under the 3553A factors. And then, as Your Honor pointed out, under Garthus and other cases from this court, when you're looking at the 3553A factors, and when you're considering, when a district court is considering diminished mental capacity, the court can consider it a mitigating factor, an aggravating factor, or neither. So the district court was well within bounds to consider defendant's diminished mental capacity as a as an aggravating factor, especially in light of the real concern here, which was the need for incapacitation for a long time. Unless this court has additional questions concerning the procedural issues or the substantive issues, government would rest on the briefs and ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Counsel, anything further, Mr. Stevenson?
Yes, Your Honor. Just to clarify a few points with regard to this court's desire for statistics, in appellant's brief, page 44, the appellant does cite to a Bureau of Justice Statistics study indicating that 43% of sex offenders feature rearrest, which is lower than the remaining population. In addition, statistics with regard to criminal history and recidivism, as well as the citation to Miller in the section where this court does note that the speculation with regard to reoffense risk runs contrary to the social science that this court has run into before. In addition, with regard to the plea agreement, there were several guideline ranges discussed involving acceptance of responsibility, the cross-reference, as the government noted, and others. And again, there was not an explicit ruling with regard to the acceptance with regard to those aspects, further adding additional guideline ranges to muddy the situation. And last but not least, with regard to the incapacitation focus of the court, the items on the record, including Mr. Anarino's significant physical disability, the lifetime supervision conditions, in this case the very stringent supervision conditions, and others, demonstrate that incapacitation was met by items far greater than the 40-year sentence in this case. And for that reason, Mr. Anarino asks that you vacate his sentence and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Stevenson, the court appreciates your willingness and that of the law school to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
Thank you.
The case is taken under